Lord Thomas Reel 2. Lord Thomas, when did you shift to driving an armoured car from the Napier lorry?
When one of the armoured car drivers went sick. You see, it wasn't very long after we got to Africa before we found that the ravages of malaria were pretty acute. Quinine or meprocrine hadn't been known of in those days. Most of the mosquitoes that were in the country were malarial carriers. And so the fellow soon became sick because we hadn't been provided with any mosquito netting, and the onset of it was tertiary malaria. You had 3 days of it, and then you suddenly, for no apparent reason, had a jolly good sweat and you got better, and off you went again. But the periods of having malaria became closer and closer and closer, and the further we got into Africa, the higher was the rate of total sickness, and fellows were sent back down the line, as we call it, to be hospitalized and given proper treatment for malaria. So that is how I became I got into the seat of a Rolls-Royce armored car.
And how long did it take you to sort of get to grips with that? Was it difficult at first? Did you
feel? No. I mean, I knew how to drive the thing and how to double deep clutch, as you had to in those days, and how to change gear properly. And it was very tricky driving because as the rain ceased and the ground got fairly hard again, we pushed on from Arusha towards a place called Dodoma, which was on the German East African railway line. And it was one of our targets to cut that line and deny its use for cross-country traffic to the enemy. And one of the troubles was, of course, that when the country dried out, it developed into a series of dry riverbeds, what were known in wet times as spruits, became dongas. And a donga was a dry river with a sandy bottom, a steep approach, and a very equally steep climb out on the other side. And you had to be very cunning with the armored car, not to drive down the slope too fast, because when you hit the more or less level riverbed, if you were going too fast, the turret would jump off its mountings and it would be a bit of a mess. And then, but you had to keep up sufficient speed to climb up the other side. Otherwise, if you stalled or didn't do it properly, you had the ignominious sight of the armored car being pulled out again, either by hordes of natives on long ropes, cables, or by spans of oxen, depending on where you were. If you were near a village where they had any oxen and that sort of thing. It was a rather horrifying experience. I remember seeing a native got his thumb in between two strands of rope, and as the strain of pulling, the chaps in front of him and the armed cars at the back, as the strain got greater and greater, this twist in the rope gradually took his thumb off. And it was nauseating, to say the least, but still, you know, we were soldiers, we didn't have to fear the sight of blood, but that was about the only blood that I saw during that campaign, anyway. Except there was sickness and dysentery and all that sort of thing. Those were medically very difficult times, because for one thing we ran away from our rations and we had to live on the land, and if you live on mealy meal, corn cob, which hasn't been properly cleaned. You get a lot of sand into your system and that upsets your digestion. And also we didn't have any proper ready supply of medicine. I think the most effective stuff was opium. The chap got very vitiated by dysentery and very weakened by malaria. He began to get hallucinations and delirium and that sort of thing, and a shot of opium acted like morphia, but I know I had some myself once, and I had the sensation that my bed, which actually was a mattress on the ground, or ground sheet, I was floating about 6 inches above it. It was a strange impression. And I was awfully glad to go to sleep, and, you know, weren't too worried about not waking up. It's a rugged campaign.
You mentioned that you'd run away from rations. What had happened then?
The vehicles coming up behind us had got stuck in the mud. See? And, we lived on bully beef and some strange things called McConaughey rations. And McConaughey rations were tinned Irish stew. And what people didn't realize in those days is that if one of the tins got punctured due to rough handling, the contents went bad. Mm. And they had to be thrown away, so you didn't have that much to eat. Really. And there were tins of biscuits, army biscuits, which were very much like dog biscuits. And once they'd been opened, it wasn't long before the native insects crawled inside and laid their eggs in the biscuits. And it was very rough going altogether. However, we got to Dodoma and cut the Deutsche Ost African Asian Bahn and found some houses there. It was a great relief to sleep in a house on a German railway man's bed, because you got a bit of comfort in it. And the weather had dried out, but the roads got better, and supplies began to catch up with us. And you've no idea how the joy it was to be able to clean our teeth with tooth powder instead of rubbing them with sand and that sort of thing. So for a little while, our lot was better. And then we had to press on down south from Dodoma to a place called Iringa, which was another river crossing. And by that time, the news came through that the German general that we were pursuing had retreated quite a long way, and it was much better for the troops in the south to come up north than for us to continue southwards from the north. So we were shipped onto trucks on the railway line and taken down to a place called Kilossa, which I believe was the most fever-stricken place in East Africa. It was the sort of place where they had 10 station masters a year because they all faded out or died. Or it was a bad place, Kilossa. And from there, we were judged medically unfit to stay in the country because, I think out of the original 35, 40 people, only about 16 remained. They began getting yellow fever and black water and all these horrible tropical diseases. So they decided to put us on the train to Dar es Salaam, in what was then Tanganyika. And from there, the battery was split up. I think 6 drivers manhandled or drove the cars on board a ship. I was one of them. And the rest of the chaps were or seconded to infantry or machine guns or something like that. And the whole thing split up. But I was lucky. I got on this nice Dutch ship and went from Dar es Salaam slowly and quietly up the Indian Ocean to Aden and then to Port Said, would it be? Yeah, or Suez. No, Port Said. And hence to Cairo. And of course the sea voyage and the ship's food and the rest did me and my companions a great deal of good physically. And so we survived, as you might say. Then when we got to Cairo, we put the cars into a place called the Gamra Garage, which the army had taken over, and set about cleaning them up and replacing such parts as we'd got spare parts for. And I remember what a joy it was on the river out from Cairo to the pyramids, which is a long, straight, flat road. We managed not only to get into top gear, which we hadn't done for about 9 months, and I found that my old car would do better than 60 miles an hour if I'd let it, but was rather chary of doing things of that sort. It was very valuable vehicle. And then in Cairo, I decided that having been a member of the officers' training corps at school, I might as well become an officer. So I applied for a transfer to the Royal Flying Corps and got it. Became a cadet, learned to fly, and was taught to fly Maurice Farman shorthorns. After that, Avro 504Ks, then I was moved to Abu Kir on the North Egyptian post. And one day, a fellow who had come out from England to form a stunt squadron or aerial fighting school, they called it AFS, he saw me foolishly looping a thing called a DH-2 de Havilland. And I didn't break it on landing. And he asked me if I'd like to join his new school as an instructor. So I only got about 10 hours on my logbook. And so I became an instructor. But that made a break in my association with armored vehicles, which wasn't resumed until after we'd all done some flying in Mesopotamia and became a major, was my giddy rank. I came back with a permanent commission in the RAF, as it was by then. But when I got to Northolt, I was stuck there with no flying, very dull. I decided to pass up my commission possibility and go into sordid commerce. And because I'd written various articles about vehicles and motor cars, and I was offered a job both by Temple Press, publishers of the motor, and by IDEF, publishers of the autocar, of which company, incidentally, the fellow Geoffrey Smith, through whose agencies I joined Armored Car. He was the managing editor, but he was later in answering my letter, and by that time I got fixed up with Temple Press, and I became a motoring writer for 3 glorious years, when it was my job to take motor cars out on test and report on their performance. I was determined that I was going to handle luxury, high-powered motor car. Well, at that time I hadn't a cat and hell's chance of keeping one myself. So I decided that motor cars have got to keep me, which happily they did. And it was while I was doing this kind of writing, testing, motor reporting job that I met the most dynamic character in Oxford called William Richard Morris, who at that time was beginning to build up his post-war motor car business again, changing from making North Sea mines and mine sinkers at Cowley to making motor cars. And I was driving with him from Oxford to Coventry one day, trying out a new Morris Oxford car to the joy of his heart. And he said, where do you live? And I said, well, I live in London. He said, oh, but you don't live nearer to Oxford. So I said, well, why? And he said, well, then you could come and work with me. So I said, well, I'm fussy where I live. I'm not married. So he said, well, I'll ring you up one day. So about 6 months after that, he rang me up at the office and he said, you know, I mentioned that there's a possibility of you coming and working with me. I said, yes. He said, well, how soon can you start? So I thought, you know, this is romance. This is what I've been wanting. So I said, well, I got a contract with Temple Press, or it's a letter of agreement. And so it's supposed to last for 6 months, but I'll see if I can get out of it a little quicker. So I had talks with Mr. Dangerfield, who was then managing director, I think it was, at Temple Press, and he said, why do you want to go? So I said, well, I think I'd have more scope there at Morris Meadows. And he said, well, if it's money, we'll offer you another £400 a year. I was getting 800 then, principally some. And I said, well, Mr. Dempsey, it was very kind of you, but if I'm suddenly worth £400 a year more, why haven't I been getting it up to now? He said, well, it's another question, isn't it? What do you decide to do? So I said, well, thank you very much indeed, but I'm going to join Mr. Morris. How soon can you release me? So then there's the usual guffawful about finding somebody else to do what I was doing. But anyway, I think it was February the 7th, 1924, that I presented myself at the Morris Works at Cowley, Oxford, and was taken on to strength. Well, taken on to strength is perhaps not the right term. I was given an office and was told what was wanted, which was for me to produce a motoring magazine. And also to promote an advertising campaign, because the motor cars weren't selling very well at the moment. So I immediately got very busy and put up the idea that we should announce that we couldn't hold the present prices of Morris cars beyond Easter, which was in the offing. Yeah? And people would be well advised to buy now, otherwise their motor cars would cost them more. Yeah? Well, that had a splendid effect on the sales. And, about 6 weeks after I'd been there, Mr. Morris's partner, a man called Platt, came to me and said, what are we paying you? So I said, well, nothing so far. Rather nice to be paid sometime. And he said, well, what were you getting? So I tell him, and he said, well, we'd better pay you the same so that we can't be accused of filching you away from your employers with whom we have very good relations. So I said, all right. Then I did mention that I'd been offered another 400 a year to stay on with Temple Press. So he said, well, you leave that to me. So that was adjusted in about 6 weeks' time or something like that. And from then, took over the advertising and the sales promotion of Morris cars and also of Morris commercial cars, and soon got involved in the heavier vehicle side because it was Morris's intention to go into that, having built up a very profitable business in the passenger car side. And it was while I was at Morris Commercial Cars as general manager, I think it was, in Birmingham, that I got involved in this cross-country vehicle technology. I'd written some papers on cross-country vehicles and the relative advantages of multi-wheeled vehicles and tracked vehicle. And that brought me into contact with the army authorities, and a remarkable, lively-minded officer called Lieutenant General Lequeux Martel. And he realized, like I had done, that the soldier would feel much more secure if he had a piece of armor plate between him and the enemy. And he tried to develop, or he actually did develop, a thing called a one-man tank. Rather, as Q Martel, I suppose, could be regarded as the pioneer of tanks, he developed the philosophy that you must be able to get off the roads and have a good cross-country performance. And it was in this capacity that we came with our drawing office facilities to his aid, and first of all developed a six-wheeled vehicle, which admittedly was lightly armored, but it did mount a two-pounder gun, which was a good deal more powerful than a rifle, of course. Anyway, it was Q Martel that sparked off the idea of a really mobile, light vehicle, and it was from that starting point that the Nuffield organization got involved in making the Crusader tank, which was very largely built out of American components, particularly the engine, which was a Liberty Aero engine, and as it turned out, was quite unsuitable for tank warfare. So I think at this point we can review the whole tank situation as it was inspired by Q Martel, aided by a body known as the Stern Committee, which was highly non-technical, but had very politically advanced ideas of armored vehicle construction.
Can I, before sort of developing that, can I ask you a few more questions about the East African thing, and I'll come back to Martel. How many actual vehicles did you have with you when you split off into a separate company?
We had four armored cars, three ammunition carriers, I think four, or perhaps it might have been six, Model T Fords. Now, Model T Ford was the most versatile vehicle. Of course, we stripped all the unnecessary bodywork off and made them into open box-like carrying devices. But they really, because they were light and they were very powerful and very simple to drive, they would stand up to all kinds of strange journeys. I remember driving one, it must have been Christmas Eve, 1916, I suppose, from Dodoma down south, through the bush, with the sort of Christmas parcel load for the chaps. And the way in which that Ford scrambled up and down the banks of spruits and dongers, and its high clearance made it quite suitable for fording rivers that an ordinary vehicle wouldn't have got through on its own. And one was full of admiration for the Model T Ford and the engineering that went into it. Yes, I think that was about our unit. Four armoured cars, two or three trucks, and either four or six Ford light vans, as you might call them. That was the unit.
Were the commanding officers, were they experienced in the use of armoured cars?
No, I don't think so. They were experienced in the use of cars. I mean, our original commanding officer was the proprietor of a garage in Johannesburg. He was a South African named Goldberg, a very cheerful, up-and-coming, go-ahead chap. And his number two was the proprietor of a garage at Chipping Norton, a man called Young. And then the number three, he again was a South African, but he was a wine grower, but he had been a keen motorist, so to speak. There was no philosophy, really, except what I've told you, but we were taught at Bisley, about armoured cars and their tactics and so forth, because it's one thing to have a tactical plan for use when the armoured car can go anywhere, cross-country and so forth, and another one where it gets bogged down and becomes a pretty easy target for the enemy's infantry, whether they're armed with bows and arrows or assegai or what have you. We had to play it by ear.